Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone if you'd like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Brady Phillips. Sir, you may begin.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. And we'll be following along a PDF of a PowerPoint presentation that you can download at the following website, www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. And that link can be found on the media advisory on the NOAA.gov homepage as well. Today, our first presenter is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. We'll provide a summary of the March U.S. and global climate reports and the drought monitor released a short time ago. The next presenter will be John Walsh, the co-director of ANOAA-RESA, the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy in Fairbanks, located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who will discuss the record or near-record low sea ice conditions in the Bering Sea and impacts to some of Alaska's coastal communities up there. And the final presenter will be Anthony Artusa, a seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest La Nina update as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the coming 3 months. So our first speaker today will be Jay Crouch from NOAA. Jay?
Hi, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number 2 on the slide deck you can download from our website, looking at global temperatures during March of 2018. These statistics were released yesterday morning, stating that the March global temperature was the 5th warmest March on record, with a globally average temperature that was 0.83 degrees Celsius above average. This was our coolest March that we've seen for global temperature since 2014, and we're about 0.7 degrees Fahrenheit below the record value that we saw in 2016, which was during a really strong El Nino event. This was the 42nd consecutive March and our 399th consecutive month that the globally average temperature has been above the 20th century mean. Looking at land and ocean surfaces separately, for land surface, it was the 7th warmest March on record, and for the ocean surface, the 5th warmest March. The graphic on the right shows how global temperatures compared to the 1981 to 2010 average during the month. We see there were quite a few regional extremes. I'll start off speaking to the cold extremes. Large parts of North America, particularly South Central Canada, the North Central U.S., as well as parts of the Eastern U.S. were fairly cold during the month, as well as much of Europe stretching into North Central Asia. Many European countries had their coldest March since 2013, including Austria, Finland, Sweden, the United Kingdom, and Spain. On the warm side, we did see some really warm temperatures and record warmth stretching from northern Africa through the Middle East into Central Asia. Numerous locations in Asia observed record warm March temperatures on the daily time scale. So these were daily measurements of high temperatures that were the highest ever observed in these countries during the month. And those included in Iraq, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan. And Bahrain had its warmest March on record. And in the southern hemisphere, New Zealand also had its warmest March on record. So March was really noted by some really large extremes on both the cold and the warm side of the spectrum during the month. Moving to slide number 3, looking at year-to-date temperatures for the global surface temperature. The global surface temperature was 0.74 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average, and this marks our 6th warmest first quarter of a year and the coldest start to a year since 2014. The graphic on the left shows January to March global temperatures back to 1880, and we can see how we're off of the really warm temperatures that we saw in 2015, 2016, and 2017, but we're still quite a bit above the rest of the pack. So we're not near record warmth, but we're still quite a bit above average. The graphic on the right once again shows those temperatures compared to the 1981 to 2010 average around the globe, and a pretty similar pattern that we saw in March is holding true for the January to March period with large regional extremes around the world. Moving on to slide number 4 to look at what happened here in the contiguous U.S. during March. The contiguous U.S. average temperature was about 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this ranked near the median value in our 124-year period of record, so near the middle of the pack. The graphic on the left shows how temperatures around the contiguous U.S. compared to average. We did see some above-average conditions, particularly across the south-central United States, with parts of New Mexico and Texas seeing much above-average conditions. And we also saw above-average temperatures in the upper Midwest and parts of New England. On the cold end of the spectrum, we did see below-average temperatures across parts of the West. The northern high plains, which has been fairly cold for several months now, as well as parts of the east. We did see some much below average conditions across parts of the mid-Atlantic during the month of March. And this really cold March in the east followed a record warm February, so many locations actually observed March temperatures that were colder than the temperatures that we observed in the preceding February. That is an unusual occurrence, but we have observed that in the past. In the eastern United States. Looking at precipitation, there were quite a few regional extremes, and when we average across the entire contiguous U.S., it was a near-average month. There were 4 nor'easters that impacted the East Coast during the month, bringing heavy snow, wind, and coastal flooding. Many locations in the East saw more snowfall during March than the preceding winter months. We did see above-average precipitation as well across the parts of the West and the high plains, and below average precipitation across parts of the Southwest, Central Plains, the Great Lakes, as well as the Southeast. Moving on to slide number 5 to look at the U.S. drought monitor that was released this morning. About 28.9% of the lower 48 is in drought, and this is down about 2.4% since late February. Even though we have seen a decrease in the overall drought footprint, the locations that have been experiencing drought have seen intensification of drought pretty rapidly, particularly across the Southwest, as well as the Southern Plains and Central Plains. Some locations in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and New Mexico have been dealing with numerous wildfires, and a really dry winter in this part of the country has led to a failure of much of the winter wheat crop in this part of the country. And we've also seen drought intensification in parts of the Southeast. And in Alaska, we've been seeing dry conditions across the panhandle of Alaska, so southern locations, including Juneau and Ketchikan, have seen really dry conditions over the past couple of months with drought emerging in that part of the country. And with that, I will pass it off to John.
Thanks. Thanks, Jake. I'm John Walsh, University of Alaska. I work with Rick Toman of the Alaska Region National Weather Service, and we've put together this summary of the unprecedented sea ice coverage in the Bering Sea this past winter. And I'll refer first to slide 6. The upper right panel shows you the history back to 1979 of the winter averaged ice cover in the Bering Sea. And you can see how the past winter, the final bar, is way below any preceding winter. Just for reference, that area of coverage, 500,000 square kilometers or so, is roughly the area of California. Down at the lower left, we provide a longer time perspective, and this is on the February ice coverage. February is the month when the ice generally approaches its maximum for the year in the Bering Sea. And at the time of late February, the area is typically about comparable to Texas in size. And you can see how 2018 is by far the lowest since 1850. That's a unprecedented 160-year record that we've just had. And it's not even close. The previous record was back in 2001. 2018 is well below. Turning to slide 7, you can see the evolution of 2017 or 2018's ice coverage in the Bering Sea. That's the red line. the black line is the median for the period back to the 1978 start of the satellite record, and the blue line on the graph is the record maximum, which was set 6 years ago, 2011-2012, and the main message there is that we're again essentially out of the previous range by quite a wide margin. We're roughly 50% of the previous low record for ice coverage in the Bering Sea. So it's an extreme event in terms of ice coverage and the associated weather, which we'll get to in a minute. Turning to slide 8, we have a few figures that get at the impacts of this absence of ice cover. There are three photos there taken by residents of coastal communities. The upper right photo is from the community of Utqiagvik, which is also known as Barrow. It's the northernmost point in Alaska. It's up at 71 degrees north. The ice cover has historically returned to Barrow in October. And in the last decade or so, November freeze-ups have become more typical. This photo was taken December 21st, the winter solstice. It's actually dark at the time. We had to brighten the photo so that it's visible. But you can see waves, which is an indication of open water at the coast at Barrow, Utqiagvik, on the winter solstice. The left photo is from a community on the west coast, Shishmaref. This was taken in late February during one of the storms that came up through the Bering Sea. You can see waves and open water. And the lower right photo was taken at Little Diomede, which is an island in the Bering Strait. And this was again taken in late February, and you can see the waves rolling into the shore. All these communities are normally socked in with ice, frozen in literally, by late February. This year they were not. There are impacts. The community members use the ice for travel between communities. That's clearly not possible when there's open water. And the subsistence hunting that normally takes place around this time of the year relies on the ice for a platform. The residents harvest seals and whales and use the ice as a platform. That's going to be the strategy will have to be revised this winter. And also the coastal storms that come along at this time of year produce flooding and erosion. If there's open water, normally the ice cover is a buffer that would protect the community. Turning to slide 9, we get at some of the reasons for why this ice cover has been so unprecedented. In essence, there are three reasons that we can point to, three factors that have been in play. One of them is the warm water in the Bering Sea, and the graphic in slide 9 shows you the central Bering Sea water temperatures averaged over December to February. The last 3 years, including this one, have been unusually warm, and this Bering Sea water temperature anomaly has persisted ever since the time of the blob a few years ago. That blob was the warm water feature in the Gulf of Alaska. The Gulf of Alaska feature has largely returned to normal, but the Bering Sea has stayed warm. So we've had unusually warm water. Second factor is that what we call the late start. The autumn was warmer than normal, both in the air, in the atmosphere, and in the water. The average or the autumn temperatures in Barrow, Utqiagvik, were a record, the highest going back to about 1900. And Nome on the west coast also had its tied for the warmest autumn on record. So we had warmth in the atmosphere as a second contributor. The third factor was persistent storminess, and that's shown in our last slide, which is slide 10. We presented here a graphic showing a metric for storminess, and we presented it as a rank. And this rank is relative to all years from 1948 onward, so there are 70 years in the sample. The graphic on the left shows the south wind component as a rank for the past 70 years. It's the south wind component of this past winter ranked relative to all the other years. And the orange and yellows are ranks in the top three or four. So what we're saying here is that this proxy for storm activity was in the top three or four out of the past 70 years. That's also true for the steering level, 500 millibars, 500 hectopascals, which is shown on the right. So the message from this slide is that the storminess was quite strong, one of the strongest on record, although not the number one. It was not the most stormy winter on record. So to put it all together, we had a combination of three factors that seemed to have been the perfect storm, so to speak, for this unprecedented ice cover. And it left us with an ice cover that was off the charts. We're still going through it now. The communities will be experiencing the impact into spring. So with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Anthony.
Okay. Thank you, John, and good morning, everyone. I'd like to start off with slide 11, where we look at the sea surface temperatures and their departures from normal over the tropical Pacific basin, and also the state of ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation. So the top map, what we're looking at there are the sea surface temperatures, or the SSTs, and especially how they depart from the past 30 years. So right now, over the central and eastern equatorial Pacific, we have below normal SSTs. They are modest, ranging up to about a half degree C below normal across that region. And we also have a small amount of below normal SSTs also right near the South American coast. And some of this could be related to the waning La Nina, actually the last vestiges of the La Nina that we've experienced this past winter. Probably it is even more related to an increase in the trade winds across that region, easterly and northeasterly flow and upwelling, resulting in a much larger cool area. Notice we have above normal SSTs over the western equatorial Pacific, most of the tropical Pacific for that as well, and also the Gulf of Mexico. So in terms of the ENSO phase, we are seeing the last vestiges of La Nina, and we expect it to transition to what we call ENSO neutral during this month and into May. Now, below that, we have another chart with the ENSO forecast from CPC and IRI. It's a probabilistic forecast. And the thinking is that the ENSO neutral that we expect to develop over the next month or so is likely to give way to perhaps a weak El Nino by October, November, and December, so during this autumn. You'll notice the red bars, which are indicative of the probabilities for El Nino. They increase with time, and they approach the 50% line sometime in the late autumn or early winter in what we call NDJ, or November, December, January. So things are certainly moving in that direction, although I do put a brief caveat here that in recent years we have had several false starts with El Niños that have been quite promising, so we don't want to jump on this just yet and go with El Niño for the winter. Though things do look like it's moving in that direction, but we're moving in that direction cautiously. Okay, so if we advance on to the next slide, number 12, you can see the forecast for May. Temperatures on the left and the precipitation on the right. The areas in red indicate an orange where temperatures are expected to be above normal. So you can see that a lot of the southern and eastern part of the lower 48 states is expected to have above normal temperatures during May. A lot of this is due to historical trends over the past, say, 10 to 15 years, temperature trends, and also a look at consideration of the ENSO state, in this case La Nina to neutral, and also we have a variety of tools and models that we can look at, both dynamic and statistical. So trends account for a big portion of the warmth out west. Also across the east, although with the lower probabilities, you can see that there is more disagreement among the tools. We're not going with much higher probabilities. Up in Alaska, most of the tools are indicating above normal temperatures. And as John was alluding to earlier, notice we have the increased probabilities of 50% or greater along parts of the North Slope and also the Bering Sea coast, and that is in part related to the earlier decay of sea ice and coastal ice, near coast ice. So that is typically what we observe, an earlier decay of the sea ice in the spring and a delayed onset in the autumn months. Between several of the tools that we have and also a weak tilt in the historical trends, we're going with below normal temperatures across the northern high plains. For the precipitation, you can see we have mostly wet conditions, and I'm sorry, but my machine just logged off, which I don't know why that happened. If you could bear with me just for a moment, and I can get this back up. I apologize for that. Okay, we're back. Don't know what that transient issue was, but for the precipitation, it's normally where you see the green shading that is representative of above normal precipitation, and the brown represents below normal precipitation. So we have an increase in odds above climatology for wetness across the eastern part of the lower 48. A lot of that comes from our historical trends and also from our climate models that we have available. The same with the northern high plains, where we expect above normal precipitation, and also the same with Alaska. The only area of relatively drier conditions that we expect will be over, let's say, from the northwest and northern California down toward the Texas and Oklahoma panhandles. Okay, so advancing on to the next slide, which would be number 13, here we look at the seasonal forecast for May, June, and July. Again, temperature on the left and precipitation on the right. Most of the most of North America in that sense, or at least for the 49 states here for the U.S., are expected to be above normal. This is shown by a variety of our different climate models and statistical tools, and also it's consistent with fairly strong trends across the southern U.S. and across the eastern U.S. at this time of year. So you can see the probabilities in the southwest go up to about 60% for above normal temperatures, and as high as 50% or more across New England. You notice over the north central lower 48 states, we're going with equal chances, and that simply means that we don't have enough information to discern or tilt the odds in any particular direction. So we're saying that below, near normal, and above normal are all equally likely. Incidentally, this is the kind of a pattern that you would start to see during the summer if an El Nino was starting to develop. So this is, in a sense, it's also pushing toward this El Nino transition. But for right now, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Right now, we're just going from the La Nina to the neutral event. For precip, again, the green areas are where we expect above normal precip across Alaska for the most part, also for much of the northeast, lower 48, and also extending westward across the Great Lakes and down into North Carolina. And then we have an area of increased odds for below normal precip across a large part of the northwest and the central Rockies and central basin. And then if we go on to our next slide, number 14, here we have the seasonal drought outlook, which just came out this morning. Notice in the brown shading, that's where the key or the legend is showing where our drought is expected to persist. In the tan shading, you can see that the drought remains but improves by one category, and that is in reference to the drought monitor classification. So that's what the drought outlook is based on. The D1 through D4 values that are based in the drought monitor. If we think drought removal is likely, that'll be shaded in that olive green color. And in areas where drought development is expected, that'll be shaded in yellow. Just a few things to mention here. In the west, we're moving into the dry season, so we would expect the drought to persist there. Across much of the plain states, Normally, this will be a pretty wet time of the year in places like the South Central and the Southern High Plains. Normally during May, June, July, during this period, they can see anywhere from 35 to up to 45% of their annual precipitation at this time, the highest amount being there in western Kansas. As we move farther north, up through the northern plains, that region sees anywhere from 45 to 65% of its annual precipitation during the next 3 months. So that's why we have, to a large degree, climatology, a wetter climatology plays a significant role in this outlook, in addition to short-term wet forecasts. And then finally, in Florida, we know May is the transitional period. Normally, we see the end of the dry season, and by the start of June, we're moving into its wet season. So we do expect drought removal across southern Florida. The areas farther to the north, across parts of the Carolinas and Georgia, are a lot less certain. There's just a lot more uncertainty with that. So with that, I'd like to turn it over then to Brady.
Thank you, Anthony. And we'll now take specific questions from the call participants. And again, please be sure to indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if at all possible. And Yumi, can you remind folks how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks.
Thank you. Participants on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Please make sure your line is unmuted and record your first and last name clearly with the prompt. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. Again, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment as questions register. Again, participants, the lines are open for questions if you have pressed star 1 and record your name. Our first question comes from Patricia Kitchen from Newsday. Your line is now open.
Oh, great. Hi. Thank you so much. So I wanted to ask a little bit about potential El Nino. I know that it is only potential, but were that to develop, around October, that's around hurricane season, and were it a weak El Nino to develop, would that – a weak, you know, the strength of it, would that – have much of an effect on hurricanes development, would you say?
Hello, this is Anthony.
Oh,
I assume that's
yes,
for
I'm
me.
Sorry. Yes, exactly.
That's okay. Sure, this is Anthony. Normally, the important thing with the El Nino and hurricane season is that you tend to get a large area of increased wind shear associated with El Nino across the Caribbean and the lower latitude Atlantic. And wind shear is generally bad for hurricanes because it essentially, tears the storms apart before they really have a chance to consolidate and turn into something very destructive. Mm-hmm. So normally that would be the case. I would think that with the uncertainty in the forecast, you still don't want to say too much about the hurricane season. At this point, because we're not really sure how established this El Nino is going to get.
Yep.
And I think we're especially cautious now with having been burned with some of these recent false starts of what look like very promising El Ninos.
Sure. At what point do you think by next month there'd be a little bit more information? I mean, clearly there would be, but would that be enough time to kind of make a better
It's a good question.
Yeah.
Right. No, that's a good question. I don't know how much more it'll be by next month, but I would think within at least the next few months,
sure.
Because normally during this time of the year, we have there's a general reduction in skill in the sea surface temperature forecasts. We tend to call it the spring barrier. So normally we like to wait to get past this period before we really get a good feel for what's going on.
Sure.
So I would think that by, say, July or probably by July, maybe even by August, I would think almost certainly by then, we should have a much better feel for it.
Okay, well, that's great. We will definitely stay tuned for that. And also, if I could ask another question, too. You had mentioned for May that one of the, you know, one of the factors behind the it looks like a slight tilt towards above normal, and I'm especially interested in the New York area, Long Island, which I think you may have a little familiarity with.
yes, I do.
You mentioned that one of the factors is historical trends, and I'm wondering, could you just say what that means? Is this historical trends,
sure,
like based on what the conditions you're looking at this point, that historically these things lead to a little bit above average? Is that what that is?
Yes. Yeah, that's the idea. What we do is we look at what we call historical trends over, say, the last 15 years or so, and we just do a basic count and see how many of those years turned out to be above normal, below normal, or near normal for the New York area and, of course, the surrounding metro, Long Island, that whole area. The trends for this time of the year, especially as you go into the summer, there is a weak tilt in the signal for wetness, you know, wetter than normal conditions. That is one of the factors that we consider. Others are we look for areas of agreement between our various climate models and also our statistical models, and they tend to be in fairly good agreement across the Northeast in general.
Okay. And seeing there may not be all that many calls this time, if I could just squeeze in one more. I get questions all the time from people, when is it going to be spring? When is it going to warm up? I know that that's a little shorter range than what, you know, what you're looking at here, but would it be starting in May that there's an indicator that things could sort of turn a little bit warmer?
That's a very good question as well. For our forecast, you notice how from May we're going with low probabilities for above normal. The reason why there's low probabilities is that we have a number of conflicting tools, a number of conflicting models or indications, and most of the guidance is hinting toward above normal for the month as a whole. However, that does not mean that every day of the month is expected to be above normal. It just means that when you take the month as a whole, the dominant category is above normal. So that's what we're thinking. How much longer this cold is going to last remains to be seen. We don't know at this time.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Our next question comes from Bryce Anderson from Progressive Farmer. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the call. I have a question that maybe all three of the panelists might weigh in on, perhaps, and that has to do with this tremendous warmth that the Bering Sea had and the northern latitudes during this past winter. And also with the cold shot that Europe went through, there's been quite a bit written in discussion over the past several weeks about the occurrence of a real sharp, almost a breakup of the polar vortex during late February and March that maybe was involved with some of these big extremes that we saw. Did that play a part in leading to the trends that we saw in March? And also, in your opinion, might that still be affecting some of the patterns that we've been experiencing here in April?
So this is Jake. I'll take a stab at part of that question. So the conditions that we saw across, here in North America and parts of Europe are consistent with what we call the North Atlantic and Arctic Oscillation. Those are two pressure patterns that set up in the North Atlantic that do have some relationship to the strength of the polar vortex. and those did indicate a somewhat weakening of the polar vortex during the month of February, which allowed these meanders in the jet stream. So it allowed warm air to intrude further north in locations, and then allowed cold air to intrude further south. And so that shows up really well on that map on slide number two with the regional extremes across the northern hemisphere. So there could be some, or there is indication that played a role during the month of March. And I know that has continued somewhat into April, but for our analysis, we haven't actually looked at April yet. We tend to do that on a monthly time scale, so I can't speak to the more recent weeks.
Mm-hmm. This is John Walsh. If I could comment with respect to the Alaska winter, I think this stratospheric warming in February was detectable in the sense that the February was a fairly warm month, and if you look at that Bering Sea history for the last winter, I think it was our slide seven, it looked like the ice cover was trying to establish itself this year in late January, early February, but then it went off track. It went back down again in early February, which is much earlier than usual. The maximum usually occurs in March, and the ice never did recover from that downward drop in February, and that was about the time of the stratospheric warming. So I think that there was a contribution there to the evolution, but again, there were other factors at work in the Alaskan story that were in place well before that stratospheric warming and the polar vortex breakdown.
I have a follow-up question, if I may, and that has to do with some studies that have also been done that relate the pronounced general warming trend in the higher latitudes to a slowing down of the and kind of a weakening of the polar jet stream and leading to some impact that way. Does the way the temperature pattern acted during March and then late winter also, as we've been looking at, does that play into that type of research as well?
I think this is John Walsh again. I think it does. There's no inconsistency there. But that connection between the higher latitude warming, they call it the Arctic amplification, and mid-latitude weather is somewhat controversial. We find examples like this winter that fit the mold of the story, but there are other winters in the past decade that don't. So we may be seeing a sort of a sporadic signal embedded in noise that's giving us these occasional linkages, but it's not something you'd want to bet the ranch on every winter.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment for additional questions. Again, participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. I'm sure
okay.
No other questions at this time.
Thank you. First of all, I'm going to wrap up the call, and I'd first like to thank all of our speakers, especially our speaker from Alaska, who had to get up early this morning, Alaska time, to participate in the call. And I'm going to end up by reminding everyone to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases. So the April U.S. Climate Highlights will be released on May 6th. The April Global Climate Highlights will be released on May 18th. The next climate call will be on Thursday, May 17th. Also, for those interested in the 2018 hurricane season outlook, We will send out a separate media advisory and post it to NOAA.gov, but it's looking like it will likely be sometime during the week of May 21st to the 24th. And so that's when the Atlantic hurricane season outlook will be given by the National Weather Service. Finally, an audio of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory site within 60 to 90 minutes of the call. And if you have further informational needs, please email me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. And this concludes the call. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by for the press conference.